Wow, it's hot. How long is he going to be?
I've no idea. When Uncle Marcus gets busy with that cine camera, there's no telling.
I'm afraid my brother takes his hobbies very seriously. You can't rush him.
At least we can try. Buck up, Marcus. Do you want us all to die of sunstroke?
Shan't be long now. When I say action, I want you to walk about, admire the ruins. If you stand there grinning, it might as well be a still photograph.
I wish it were. Then we could get a move on. Where are we anyway?
Well, this is Pompeii, isn't it?
I know that, fathead. I mean, which bit is this?
Oh, hang on. Let's look in the guidebook. Ah, here we are. The Street of Tombs, site 39. 3 stars. The house of Aulus Lepidus, the poisoner. Oh, sorry, did I say something I shouldn't?
No, it's all right. It's nothing.
Leave this to me. You haven't known us very long, George, but since we all met on the ship, you and Marjorie have become good friends, so it's only fair to explain. We decided to take this cruise because we all wanted to get away from England for a while. You see, we come from a small village called Silbury Cross.
Yes, and Marjorie told me.
But I don't expect she told you that in Silbury Cross there's a criminal lunatic who goes around poisoning people for fun.
What?
Don't, please.
Right, are you ready? Look as if you're enjoying yourselves. Action!
We present Donald Sinden as Dr. Gideon Fell in The Black Spectacles by John Dixon Carr.
Extracts from notes made by me, Gideon Fell, on August the 10th, 1938, concerning the mystery at Silbury Cross. I had already heard something of the matter when Chief Superintendent Hadley called to see me at Adelphi Terrace.
The Chief Constable, Major Crowe, has asked for assistance. Apparently the local chaps haven't reached any definite conclusion. The trouble is, the outbreak of poisoning happened 3 months ago, so the trail's pretty cold. But since the Chesney party got back from their Mediterranean cruise, things have turned nasty. Anonymous letters, messages scrawled on walls, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know. The villagers think one of the family was responsible. Now, tell me, how many people have been poisoned?
3 children and an 18-year-old girl, all dosed with strychnine. One of the children died. As for the others, it was touch and go for a while, but they recovered.
Was there any connection with the Chesney family?
Well, Marjorie was particularly fond of the boy who died, 8-year-old Frankie Dale. His death nearly drove her into a nervous breakdown. That was the principal reason for their trip abroad.
Yes, I know that too.
Oh, really? Would you mind telling me how?
Well, a few days ago, I received a letter from Marcus Chesney, the head of the family. I know him slightly. We have a mutual friend. I believe he has rather a splendid house.
He does. It's called Bellegarde, named after a peach. He's got 1/2 acre of glass houses and grows prize peaches for the luxury market. Marjorie Wills is his niece, the daughter of his late sister. A nice girl, I believe, though she's got a bit of a temper. He also has a brother, Dr. Joseph Chesney, but he doesn't live at Bellegarde. He has his own house and consulting rooms at the other end of the village.
Who else was in the cruise party?
An old school friend of Marcus, a retired professor named Ingram. He lives in a small cottage on the Bellegarde estate.
Well, in his letter, Marcus mentions a Mr. Harding.
Ah, now, George Harding wasn't one of the Silbury Cross party. They met him on the cruise. He and Marjorie took to one another at once. It soon turned into a romance, and now they're officially engaged with Marcus's blessing.
Yes, he says as much in his letter. Yeah, but since their return...
They hoped that by the time they got back, the trouble would have blown over.
But it hadn't.
Far from it. The village has made up its mind that Marjorie was responsible for the poisonings. They're all up in arms, demanding she should be arrested, although there isn't a shred of evidence.
Yes, Marcus wants me to clear her name.
And Major Crowe wants me to find the poisoner.
Which would seem to indicate a certain amount of teamwork. When do we start?
I should be able to get away early this evening.
Even so, Silbury Cross took some time to find. A thick fog reduced our progress to a steady crawl. When we finally reached the local police station, it was nearly 11:30.
Major Crowe, I must apologise for keeping you waiting, but visibility was practically nil. And in these narrow country lanes...
Well, it can't be helped. At least you're here now. Dr. Fell, I take it you're acquainted with the relevant facts about Chesney's family and friends?
Oh, yes. Although we don't have much information about the people who work at Bellegarde. The household staff, the gardeners and so on.
They all live in the village, I believe.
That's right. They come into work every morning. Apart from Walter Emmett, that is.
Emmett?
The manager of the estate, in charge of the glasshouses and the marketing. He's a decent chap. Worked at Bellegarde since he was a lad. He's not married, so he lives in case of a sudden frost or a violent storm. He likes to be on hand so he can cope with serious emergencies.
But not as serious as the emergency we have to investigate. What can you tell us about this outbreak of poisoning? Where did it begin?
In Mrs. Terry's shop. Sweet shop, newsagent, tobacconist. She's a good soul, very obliging. Of course, the tragedy upset her very much, but nobody blames her. It's not her fault if some lunatic doses chocolate creams with strychnine.
You mean someone went in and deliberately...
introduced poison sweets among the ones on display. Yes, I'm afraid so.
How were they displayed? In a glass case?
On top of the counter were two open boxes. One of chocolate caramels, the other chocolate creams. If you wanted something from one of the shelves behind the counter, Mrs. Terry would climb a pair of steps to fetch it. And while her back was turned, it would be easy to drop the chocolates you'd already poisoned into the open box.
And when do you think this took place?
Friday, May 27th. We can be fairly certain of that because Thursdays, being market day, are always busy. And she'd nearly sold out of chocolate creams. She had to put out a new box first thing on Friday morning, and there were no reports of any illnesses on the Thursday night.
So the poisoned sweets must have been planted sometime on the Friday. I don't suppose you have a list of the customers who visited the shop on that particular day?
Oh, we've done our homework. Sergeant Harris has the names. I warn you, it's a long list.
Any members of the Chesney household?
Yes. Marcus Chesney went in for cigarettes. Dr. Joe Chesney bought some pipe tobacco. And neither Professor Ingram nor Walter Emmett went in.
How about Marjorie Wills?
I was just coming to that. She'd been to the grocer's, where she happened to see young Frankie Dale. Now, according to another customer, she said, "Frankie, will you run down to Mrs. Terry and buy me some chocolate creams?" And she gave him the money. He ran all the way there and back, and when he gave her the sweet, she said, "They're for you. It's a thank you for sorting out that muddle over our Sunday paper last weekend." Frankie always delivered their newspapers.
What about the other children? There were two others, I believe.
Well, just before the shop closed, Doris Carter, who works as a nursery maid for the Andersons, came in with their two children and bought some chocolate creams. After supper, the children were allowed one each and complained that they tasted bitter. Now, when Doris tried one herself, she decided they'd gone bad and put them aside to take back the next day. That night, all three were violently ill, but they recovered, thank God.
Tell me about the boy, Frankie.
Well, unfortunately, he wasn't so particular. He wolfed the lot. The cramps started about an hour later, and he died in terrible pain at 10:30 that night.
Poor little devil. How about the Andersons' chocolates? Were they sent away for examination?
Naturally. They'd been carefully injected with strychnine through a hypodermic syringe. The needle marks were almost invisible.
But where would Marjorie have got a hypodermic, let alone a quantity of strychnine?
She's very friendly with Dr. Joe. Always in and out of his house. He does keep strychnine in his surgery, and he might have left a few grains lying around. Well, as I say, since they all got back from their trip abroad, local feelings have been running wild. They know Marjorie gave the lad chocolates, and they're out for blood.
Yes, Marcus wrote to me the other day, asking for help and advice.
He says they're threatening to smash up his greenhouses. He marched in here demanding instant results. If we couldn't solve the mystery, he'd do it for us. Then he began asking a lot of silly questions.
What sort of questions?
Oh, he wanted to know the exact size of the chocolate boxes on Mrs. Terry's counter. When I said I didn't know, he told me I lacked the power of observation, like everyone else.
Yes, that's one of his pet theories. He says most people are incapable of describing what they see. In fact, he's challenged me to...
Come in.
Excuse me, sir. Telephone call from Dr. Chesney. He must speak to you right away.
Right. Back in a moment, gentlemen.
He wasn't gone very long, but by the time he came back, His manner had changed. His face was very grave.
Sorry to have kept you waiting, but I'm afraid the situation has developed dramatically. Joe Chesney tells me that his brother Marcus is dead.
Marcus?
Apparently poisoned with cyanide. And, well, I can scarcely believe this myself, but...
Go on.
He also says three people watched Marcus being poisoned, right in front of them. But not one of them can say what happened.
This is Bellegarde. Quite impressive.
No lights at the front of the house.
There's a blaze of light across the lawn, over to the left.
Ah, that'll be the music room. The French windows must be open. Come on.
It must be a very powerful light. Hello. What's all this?
Outside the windows, various articles were scattered on the grass. A slouch hat, a long raincoat, a brown muffler, together with a pair of dark glasses, and a black Gladstone bag. Entering the room, we found a man sitting at a table, lit by a brilliant photoflood lamp, and we recognized the smell of bitter almonds. Marcus Chesney was slumped in his chair, his face purple and swollen, with traces of froth on his lips. There were two objects on the table, a pencil and a box of chocolates with a pattern of flowers on the lid. A wall clock showed the time.
12:45, which, according to my watch, is correct.
Major Crowe, oh, thank God you're here.
Chief Superintendent Hadley, Dr. Gideon Fell, Dr. Joseph Chesney.
How do you do?
So tell us, what the devil's been going on?
Well, I wish I could. I wasn't here when it happened, and as soon as I arrived, I had to go upstairs to attend to another emergency. Walter Emmett.
Emmett? You don't mean he's...
No, he's not dead. He's got a severe concussion, a nasty crack on the back of his head.
How on earth did he get that?
Look, would you mind if we moved into the other room? I thought I was beyond squeamishness, but when it's your own brother, it's
a... I'm sure we can appreciate that. And the ambulance will be here soon. After you, Doctor.
We followed him through a curtained arch into the connecting room. The curtains were wide open, with three chairs standing in a row, facing the grisly scene. At that moment, the photoflood bulb went out, as if to say that the drama had ended, while Dr. Chesney went on to explain the events leading up to his brother's death.
I was here earlier when the argument began. Marcus said that after an accident, most witnesses can never tell you what they've seen, and offered to test his theory by staging a sort of charade. But I had to visit a patient at the other end of the village, a difficult confinement. Now, he said the show wouldn't start till midnight, so I said I'd try to get back if I could. I arrived at 12:10. Too late to help him, poor old boy.
So, three people actually watched the show?
Yes. They saw every move the murderer made, but they can't agree on anything that happened.
And those three people were...
Professor Ingram, Marjorie, and her fiancé, George Harding, who is staying for the weekend. Well, at least... one good thing's come out of this damn business.
I beg your pardon?
Well, in the last few months, some people have accused my niece of being a murderer. But whoever killed my brother, whoever the poisoner is, it can't be Marjorie. And, well, if Marcus had to peg out to prove that, it's worth it.
Excuse me, Uncle Joe.
Hmm?
Could you go up to Walter? There's something about the way he's breathing.
Oh, yes, of course. Right away.
Miss Wills, this is Chief Superintendent.
Oh, that light's gone out. The bulb can't have burned out already, surely. Oh, I beg your pardon. Did you say something?
This is Chief Superintendent Hadley from Scotland Yard. and Dr. Gideon Fell.
I suppose you've come to arrest me. Sorry.
No, but we'd like to ask you a few questions.
It might be a bit easier if we closed these curtains.
I expect you want to know how all this began.
Well, yes, indeed, I do.
During dinner, Uncle Marcus was saying that people can never describe what they've seen.
And you disagreed with your uncle?
I told him that might be true about men, but women were far more observant. Of course, Uncle insisted he was right. Then he asked George to take his cine camera and film the whole thing, so there wouldn't be any arguments afterwards.
Great Jupiter! Do you mean to say that you've got it all on film?
Yes. That's why he used a photo flood lamp.
So as soon as we get the film processed...
Now, one moment. Now, we know you and Mr. Harding and the professor made up the audience. And what about the gentleman who got bashed over the head?
Walter was Uncle's assistant. He was supposed to be the other actor in the show, though we didn't know that. He came in dressed in some old clothes and...
What time was this?
Well, we took our places at about 5 to 12. The curtains were closed like they are now. Then Uncle came through and gave us a little lecture. Our half of the room had to be in total darkness and we mustn't speak during the show. Then he opened the curtains and sat down at the table and then...
Go on.
On the table, there was a box of chocolates, a pen and a pencil. He picked up the pencil, then the pen, and pretended to write. Then the French windows opened and that horrible man came in.
Can you describe his appearance?
George says he looked like the bogeyman, and he did. He had a slouch hat and a long raincoat with the collar turned up and a muffler round his face. He wore black glasses and he was carrying a black bag, which he put down on the table. Uncle said, "You've done now what you did before. What other things will you do?" And the bogeyman produced a pillbox and shook out a green capsule, the kind they used to give children castor oil. And he tipped back Uncle's head and forced the pill down his throat. It was horrible. Then he picked up his bag and went out. Uncle just sat there fidgeting with the pen and pencil. Then suddenly he flopped forward onto his face.
But that wasn't how we found him.
Oh, no. He got up and bowed and closed the curtains. We waited for something else to happen. But then he turned the lights on and came in with a piece of paper saying we had to answer some questions.
Wait, did you ask him any questions?
The professor said, "Who was your weird companion?" Uncle laughed and said that was Walter. He helped me plan it. Then he called, "All right, Walter, you can come in now." But there was no answer. We found Walter outside the French windows with blood trickling from his mouth. He'd been unconscious for some time. So the bogeyman wasn't Walter after all, and that was when Uncle Marcus collapsed.
Marjorie! My God, what have you been saying to her? Hasn't she suffered enough?
George Harding's outburst was cut short by the arrival of an ambulance to collect the body, and Marjorie went up to her room to lie down. While the police procedures were carried out, Hadley and I began our own investigations, finishing up in the library, where Major Crowe introduced us to Professor Ingram.
How do you do? I was about to say this is a great pleasure, Dr. Fell, but under these circumstances, well, you know what I mean.
I do indeed, yes. We're sorry to intrude on you at a time like this.
We have a job to do. I'm sure you both understand that.
Of course. We're only too anxious to help.
Well, in that case, Mr. Harding, perhaps I might begin by asking how long you've known Miss Wills.
Well, actually, it's very strange because we only met a few weeks ago on the ship. But I feel as if I'd always known her. I suppose it was a case of love at first sight for both of us.
Oh, congratulations. And I'm told you filmed the observation test this evening.
That's right. Mr. Chesney asked me to do it, and I said I'd be happy to oblige.
And the film still in the camera?
I've got it here. I expect you want to take a look at it.
We certainly do. We'll have it processed as soon as possible.
I'll get my men onto it. And Mr. Watkins, our local chemist, is a cine film enthusiast. He'll see to it. Mr. Harding, may I?
Of course. Here you are.
Yeah, meanwhile, what can you tell us about the actual performance?
Well, I was concentrating on the camera, keeping it focused. But I've got a pretty good eye for details. In my line of business, we have to...
What exactly is your business, Mr. Harding?
I'm a research chemist, working on a new method of electroplating. It's very interesting.
Well, since you have an eye for details, and since we know Walter Emmett did not take part in the performance, what can you tell us about the appearance of the so-called bogeyman?
Ah, that's tricky. He was heavily disguised.
But nothing about him that struck you as familiar?
No, not really.
Professor, did he remind you of anyone?
I'm afraid not.
Yes, he He must have been one of the household.
What on earth makes you say that?
Because he knew what he had to wear and what he had to do. Otherwise, Marcus would have realized right away that something was wrong. I can only assume that someone overheard Marcus and Emmett earlier when they were making their plans.
You mean one of the family circle?
But that's impossible. Tonight, George and Marjorie and I were all watching the show. And Joe was out seeing one of his patients.
But you were all in total darkness. One of you could have slipped out and taken Emmett's place and returned before the performance ended.
When you say one of us, since George was fully occupied with the cine camera at the time and obviously couldn't have been Marjorie, am I to understand that you're accusing me of murder?
At present, we're not accusing anybody, but...
Perhaps you can enlighten us upon another point. Marjorie says there were some objects on the table. A box of chocolates, a pen and a pencil. When we arrived, the pencil and the chocolates were still in place, but there was no sign of a pen. Did Marcus use a pen?
Yes. First to use the pencil, then the pen.
I don't think so. It had a pointed end like a nib, but it was too thin for a pen. In fact, it looked more like one of those poison darts that savages use with a blowpipe.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
Why not? It's just the sort of thing Marcus would do to fool us. But there was also a serious purpose to the whole business. It wasn't just an observation test. It was to demonstrate how the chocolates in the sweet shop could have been poisoned without anybody noticing.
Did he tell you that?
No, but he dropped a hint. Before we went into the music room, I drew him aside and asked him what he was up to. And he said, watch carefully because you might see how the chocolates were poisoned, though I bet you won't spot it.
Oh, yes, I know all about that.
What do you mean?
Well, I know how it was done. It was very simple.
Sorry to trouble you, sir.
Yes, what is it, Sergeant?
Miss Wills is here. She's feeling better and she'd like to join you, if that's all right.
By all means. Come in, Miss Wills.
Thank you. I'm sorry I was so stupid. I'll be fine now.
One other thing, sir. I'd appreciate a private word, if you can spare a minute.
Very well. What is it, Harris?
Sit down, my dear. Now, do you feel sufficiently recovered to answer a few more questions?
Look here, is this really necessary? She's had a terrible shock.
Marcus Chesney had prepared a list of questions which he intended to put to you. It was still in his pocket, and it might help us considerably if you'd try to answer those questions now.
I'm sure we shall do our best.
Thank you. The first question. At what time did the performance begin?
Midnight.
Yes, it was about midnight.
In fact, it was 1 minute before midnight. I made a particular note of the time.
You mean you looked at your watch?
Oh, no, we were in pitch darkness, but I could see the clock on the wall behind Marcus.
So could I, and I still say it was midnight.
Of course, the clock could have been wrong.
It wasn't. I checked that when we arrived.
Yeah, but Marcus might have put the clock forward or back while the curtains were closed. That could have been another of his little tricks.
No, it couldn't. You can't alter the time on that clock. Somebody broke the little spindle that turns the hands. It's never been mended. Besides, what difference would it make?
It would make a big difference to the alibi of someone who wasn't here at midnight.
You mean, surely you're not suggesting...
Well, let's try the next question. Was there a box on the table? If so, can you describe it?
Of course there was. A box of chocolates. With a pattern of green flowers.
Sorry, my dear. Yes, there was a box, but the flowers were blue.
Yeah, well, it's not worth arguing about. As it happens, you're both right and both wrong. Next question. Which objects did I pick up from the table?
Well, George says a pen, and the professor described it as a poisoned dart from a blowpipe.
What nonsense! George is right, it was a pen.
Oh, very well. So let's press on. Did anyone speak?
The bogeyman never said a word. But as I told you, Uncle said, you've done now what you did before. What else will you do? That was all.
Not quite. When the stranger first appeared, George said something. You whispered, here comes the bogeyman, didn't you, George?
Do we have to keep going over and over it? How many more questions are there?
Only one more. Did the intruder remove anything from the table?
No.
No.
I'm sorry. When he came in, he put his bag on the table, and then he took the bag out with him.
Quite so. He also removed a green-flowered box of chocolates, having substituted a blue-flowered box, which is there now. The first box is still inside the Gladstone bag. When the ambulance arrived, I took the opportunity to examine the objects outside on the lawn. The black bag has a false bottom with a concealed spring in the handle, the kind that conjurers use to make things appear and disappear. That's how the trick was done. And, as Marcus hinted, that is how a box of poisoned chocolates replaced the ones in Mrs. Terry's shop.
Well, Superintendent, how are you getting on?
Slowly but surely. Dr. Fell's made an interesting discovery. And I think we've established that all the members of the household have a cast-iron alibi for the time of Marcus Chesney's death.
Well, that does surprise me. Because Sergeant Harris has also made an interesting discovery, which indicates that the murderer is either a member of the household or closely connected with it.
I don't understand.
In one of the bathrooms, he found a medicine cabinet containing a box of castor oil capsules.
Well, that's hardly surprising. They're common enough.
Yes. But tucked away at the back of the shelf, he also found a 1-ounce bottle of prussic acid.
Ah. Mr. Harding, you're a research chemist. Do you use that sort of thing in your work?
No, I do not.
But I expect you could make it.
Well, yes, of course. So could anyone. It's not that complicated.
Very well. By tomorrow, we should have a great deal more information. There's every hope that Walter Emmett will have regained consciousness and be able to answer some questions. And Harris tells me that Mr. Watkins will have the cinefilm ready to show us tomorrow morning.
I'm delighted to hear it. Though, of course, it won't be tomorrow. Since it's now 1:30 a.m., tomorrow is today.
Good morning. Do you realize it's after 9 o'clock? I thought you were an early riser.
So I am. As a rule, I had a broken night.
Well, cheer up. You'll feel better when you've had something to eat. For a simple village pub, they do a magnificent breakfast. Grilled ham, deviled kidneys, eggs, sausages, fried tomatoes.
Oh, no, please, not for me, thank you, no. In the usual way, I enjoy a cooked breakfast as well as anybody. But in the atmosphere of a bar parlour, last night's cigarette smoke and the smell of stale beer, I shall content myself with a strong cup of tea.
And now me. What kept you awake then?
Thank you. I slept until 3, then woke up with a start and said to myself, "Oh, Lord, oh, Bacchus, what a blind fool I am."
Really? Any particular reason?
I realized I'd made a very stupid mistake. Consider a box of chocolates, a large box of chocolates. What do we expect to find in it?
Chocolates?
Oh, please. As a general rule, they have more than one layer, don't they? 2 at least, or even 3.
Yes, I suppose so. What about it?
We've been imagining that someone stepped the poisoned chocolates into an open box on Mrs. Terry's counter. But we know now that it wasn't like that. Our murderer replaced one box with another. So, what was to stop him putting the poisoned chocolates into the second or third layer? Which means that they could have been in the shop for several days before anyone reached the ones that had been doctored. Whenever the poisoner took them into the shop, I'll lay you odds it was well before the fatal 27th of May.
Thanks very much. You realize that leaves us worse off than we were before. Now we have no idea when the murderer went into the shop, except that it wasn't the one day the police have been concentrating on.
True, yes, up to a point. But we are not worse off than before. This could lead us to the answer.
How?
We know that our murderer must have gone in with a large Gladstone bag, similar to the one that Marcus used in his performance.
Now, hang on. We still don't know how the dickens Marcus got hold of a thing like that.
By mail order, I imagine, from one of those firms selling magic paraphernalia. It's simple enough. But since we are pretty sure that the murderer was someone known to Mrs. Terry, it would have aroused her curiosity if he'd placed a large black bag on the counter. Mm. She'd say, "Going away somewhere, sir, are we? Off to London, are we?" And even if she didn't say it, the incident would stick in her mind. Unless...
Oh, I see. Unless the murderer was somebody who often carried a black bag, in which case she wouldn't give it a second thought.
Yes. And who usually carries a thing like that?
I think Dr. Chesney has some explaining to do.
Yeah, we're all in good time. Before we do anything else, we must take a look at that cine film. What was the name of our obliging local chemist?
Mr. Watkins?
Good morning, gentlemen. What can I do for you?
I believe you're expecting us. My name's Hadley, and this is Dr. Gideon Fell.
Good morning.
Ah, yes. Come in, Superintendent Dr. Fell.
And is the film ready to be seen?
I hope you're not about to tell us that the young man with the camera left the lens cap on.
Oh, no, no, nothing like that. Now, I have the projector ready and waiting upstairs in my little den. Now, the processing took rather longer than I'd anticipated. Yeah, the film was slightly underexposed, but I managed to correct that eventually.
My dear chap, you must have been up half the night. You have my deepest sympathy. I know the feeling.
No, I enjoyed it. It was quite fascinating.
Oh, was it?
Well, yes. You understand, I had to run the film once or twice to make sure it was all right. I hope I didn't do wrong.
Well, not at all, provided you don't tell anyone else what you've seen.
Oh, certainly not. No, mum's the word, as they say. But you've certainly got some unusual things on that film. Clues, I suppose you'd call them. Most unusual.
Unusual? In what way?
Well, the second thing Mr. Chesney picks up and pretends to write with, I wasn't sure at first, so I stopped the film and took a magnifying glass to the screen, and it was so absurd that...
Quiet! Please,
what?
I thought I saw a shadow at the window. Someone outside. Perhaps I was mistaken.
I'm sorry. You were about to tell us...
No. One moment, if you please. Now, Mr. Watkins, let me ask you about your stock in trade. Now, how are you off for poisons?
Poisons?
Yes. Do you have any prussic acid? Well, how about potassium cyanide?
Oh, no prussic acid, sir. I do carry one or two preparations containing potassium cyanide, but I haven't sold any for 18 months or more. I can show you the register if you like.
No, that won't be necessary. But tell me, do you also sell photo-flood lamps?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Oh, splendid. Now then, if I bought one and kept it switched on, how long would it be before it burned out?
Oh, but you're not supposed to do that. No, you should switch it off as soon as you've finished the photographic session.
Yeah, quite so. But let's assume that I'm being particularly stupid. How long?
I'd say well over an hour at least.
Excellent, yes. And did anyone from Belgard buy one of those lamps?
Let me see. Oh, yes. Round about this time yesterday, Miss Wills came in and asked for one. Oh, good gracious. Talk of the devil. Oh, I beg your pardon. I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean
Miss
anything.
Miss Wills, what's wrong?
Nothing. I thought I saw...
Oh, my front door.
Half brick. Stand back, please.
My dear, are you all right? Mr. Watkins, can we have a chair?
Don't bother. I'm not hurt. And I should be used to it by now. They all hate me.
Here you are, if you care to sit down.
Now, take deep breaths. Everything's all right now.
All right. Look at that broken glass. I mean, why do they have to smash my front door? It's not as if I've done anything to deserve it.
What do you mean? You think I have?
Now, steady now. Deep breaths.
No luck. Whoever it was, he legged it.
I'm sorry. I should have known better than to...
Well, perhaps you could tell us why you're here.
I had to come and find you. Major Crowe's at Belgard. He wants to see you right away.
Why? What's happened?
Something so terrible. Walter Emmett. Poor Walter. He's dead.
I'm very sorry. I suppose the concussion was more serious than anybody...
No, you don't understand. Uncle Joe says someone must have gone into his room during the night with a hypodermic full of prussic acid and injected it into his arm.
I've met the powers of hell before now, but never when they moved with such deliberate and thoughtful care.
One thing I don't understand. The Major knew we were here. Why didn't he telephone instead of...
He tried. I mean, he asked me to phone you, but this line must be out of order.
Well, could you try your phone, Mr. Watkins?
Yeah, of course. Miss Wills, I'm so very sorry. Oh, I don't know what to say. Hello? Operator. I was just checking the line, but it seems to be all right now. Sorry to have troubled you.
Don't hang up. Get on to Belgard, would you, please? I'd like to speak to Major Crowe. Is it possible to take the phone through into the back room?
Yes, of course. I'll lead the way.
It's so awful.
Yes, I know, but try not to upset yourself.
I can't help it. I keep thinking about Walter. He'd never done anything to hurt anyone. I was very fond of him. I've known him ever since I was a little girl. He'd have done anything for me. Last night, Uncle Joe said that this morning he'd be able to speak and tell us what happened. And now, why should anyone want to kill Walter?
I think you've just answered your own question.
Oh. Yes, I see. And everything used to be so wonderful. We thought that things were going so well from that first day in London when I met George and we fell in love. It was just...
Just a minute. Did you say you met him in London?
Damn. I'm such a fool. Oh, what does it matter? Why shouldn't you know? I can tell you the whole story now.
Now, last night, George said he felt as if he'd known you for a long time. I take it he had.
Yes. We met in London early last year when I was taking an art appreciation course, and we fell for one another right away. I didn't tell Uncle Marcus because I knew he wouldn't approve, but when George asked me to marry him, I thought if Uncle found out we'd been meeting secretly, there'd be a terrible ruction. So when he planned a holiday abroad, I persuaded George to book a ticket on the same cruise. He'd been working very hard. He really needed a holiday.
And you pretended to meet accidentally.
That's right. And everything worked out so well. Uncle really took to him. They all did.
Thanks, Mr. Watkins. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting. I spoke to the chief and he's coming over right away to watch the film.
Did you explain that Marjorie was here?
Yes. He's arranged for the police car to take her back to Belgarde. Look, I'm afraid we can't invite you to stay and watch the film, Miss Wills. We haven't seen it ourselves yet.
That's all right. I'm not sure I want to see it anyway.
When Major Crowe arrived and Marjorie went back to Belgarde, Mr. Watkins, having repaired his front door as best he could, took us up to his den, where we sat facing the screen. He pulled down the blinds to darken the room, then took up his post beside the projector.
Ready when you are, gentlemen.
Now, before we start, what do we expect to see?
We expect to see our murderer, though I'm not sure we shall be able to identify him.
What do you think, Dr. Fell?
I think on some points I'm certain what we shall see. On other points I'm uncertain what we shall see. On any remaining points, I don't give a tinker's cuss what we see, provided we are allowed to shut up and see it.
Oh. Right. I'll carry on, Watkins.
Very good, sir.
Nothing but blackness. No, a chink of light.
As Marcus opens the curtains. The picture's a bit wobbly, but Mr. Harding admitted that he was not an expert cameraman. That's more like it. Settle down. Marcus sits at the table.
Well, luckily, the focus is sharp. You can even see the clock. 1 minute before midnight. The professor was right about that.
He's picking up the pencil as he's going to write. Now he's picking up the pen. No, is it a pen? Now, wait a minute. Stop the film.
Ah, you spotted it. I thought you would. It does look a little bit like a pen nib, but...
It's the minute hand from a clock.
In fact, it's the minute hand from that clock on the wall.
But you can see both hands on the clock.
What appears to be a minute hand is the shadow of the hour hand. Marjorie, sitting in the middle, said it was midnight exactly. The professor, sitting on her right, said it was 1 minute before midnight. All Marcus had to do before the show began was to unscrew the minute hand and put it on the table. When it was over, he replaced the hand before opening the curtains to take a bow. The question is, what was the time exactly?
Well, the hour hand's pointing to 12, so...
But the hour hand moves so slowly. I mean, it could have been anything between 5:02 and 5:05.
Which means Dr. Chesney's alibi is shot to blazes.
That's true. If he left his patient at midnight, or a few minutes before, and he said it was 10 past when he got back, at that time of night he could easily have got through the village in 15 minutes.
If he'd overheard Marcus and Emmett making plans earlier, he could have seized the opportunity. But he'd have to kill Emmett as well, because Emmett would have known the trick with the clock. And unlike anyone else, Joe Chesney knows how to use a hypodermic needle. Right, Doctor?
You mean, I'd like to see the rest of the film. Mr. Watkins, would you mind?
Oh, yes. Yes, certainly.
And here comes the bogeyman. He looks directly into the camera. Could that be Dr. Chesney?
Hard to say. He's turning away, putting his black bag on top of the chocolate box.
Which is when he's switched the boxes. Now Marcus is saying something to him.
Something like, you've done what you did before.
And now he's taking out the pill box, tilting back Marcus's head, giving him the capsule.
And now he's going out, and that's the end of it.
Well, it's got to be Dr. Chesney. No one...
You can't pin it on the doctor just because he had a shaky alibi. You have no proof. And what motive did he have to kill his brother?
Marcus was a rich man. I dare say the estate will pass to his immediate family, right, Major?
I believe so, yes. Well, thanks for your help, Watkins. And if you ever breathe a word of anything you've seen or heard in this room, I shall personally come round here and break your neck. Understood?
Oh, yes, Major. Mum is definitely the...
Right, I asked my driver to come and pick us up. The car should be waiting down below.
I get the feeling that you have something you wish to say, Major.
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I was anxious to get away before Watkins put two and two together. You see, when you suggested that Marcus's brother had a strong motive for murder, that would apply just as well to Marjorie.
She couldn't have dressed up as the bogeyman.
She could have had an accomplice. She'd known Walter Emmett since she was a child. He was devoted to her. If she were the one who overheard Marcus and Emmett planning their performance, she could have persuaded him to give her uncle the capsule and then slipped out to meet him when he came off stage, so to speak.
And bashed him over the head, knocked him unconscious. I mean, damn it, man, you'd be saying next she poisoned the blasted chocolates as well.
I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you this in front of Watkins, but we do have some new evidence.
Oh?
Last week, a young woman went into a backstreet chemist in Reading saying she needed cyanide of potassium for photographic purposes. Now, when the chemist questioned her, it was obvious she knew nothing about photography. She lost her nerve and ran away. He reported it to the police, and this morning he read about Marcus's death in the papers. There was a picture of the Chesney family, and he recognized Marjorie at once.
Oh, dear. I'm very sorry to hear that. Ah, Belgar already. Perhaps I could have a quiet word with the young lady on my own. Miss Wills. Marjorie. I'm sorry to creep up on you like this, but it's necessary for us to have a conversation.
Oh, you startled me.
Yes, I was afraid so. That's why you didn't phone Mr. Watkins. You never use a telephone, do you? But you're a very skillful lip reader.
How did you find out?
Now, the first time we met, it struck me as odd that you didn't hear something that Major Crowe said to you. And I'm afraid I was rather suspicious when Mr. Watkins' telephone was out of order.
I manage very well, as a rule. Most people never guess. I'm not ashamed of my deafness, but I don't see any reason to go around proclaiming the fact. It doesn't make any difference, does it?
No. It might even be helpful. But I really came to ask you something else. Could you tell me why you went to Reading and tried to buy some poison?
I thought no one knew. But when he started asking questions, I lost my head and ran out.
Yes, but I still don't know why you wanted it.
It was because I wanted to kill myself.
Ah. And why would you want to do that?
Can you imagine what it's like? Living under the strain of being suspected of murder. Hated by everyone. Accused of killing the boy. Expecting to be arrested every day, only there wasn't enough evidence.
But surely when you went away on holiday...
Yes. I was happy then, for a while. But when we came back, it was worse than ever.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant George had been welcomed into the family circle. You're going to be married. You've got everything to live for.
I'm not sure it will ever happen. Frankie, Uncle Marcus, and now Walter. It seems as if there's some terrible curse on the people I love. George might change his mind, and I wouldn't blame him if he did.
Mr. Hardy! Sorry. I know I shouldn't have listened at the door, but thank God I did. Marjorie, my dearest, don't you understand? I love you. I love you with all my heart, and I don't care what anyone says. I want to marry you.
Starling, I understand how you feel, but under the circumstances, I must ask you to be patient.
I can't. Marry me, darling. We'll get a special license tomorrow.
Realizing that it would be tactful to leave them together, I went out into the garden to join Hadley and Major Crowe.
It's good to be outdoors, enjoying the sunshine. Away from possible eavesdroppers.
Yes, certainly. A little daylight and our problems, they'll soon resolve themselves.
You think so?
Of course. We've got a clear case at last. The girl was our chief suspect right from the start, only we never had a motive. But now it's staring us in the face. According to the terms of her uncle's will, she's going to be very wealthy.
Well, as you said, that also applies to her uncle Joe.
Oh, the estate will be divided between them, I know that. But everything points to the girl as the guilty party. She killed the paper boy and damn near polished off three more the same way.
Wholesale poisoning, with no motive whatever?
But there could have been a very clear motive.
I don't follow you.
If it hadn't been for the sweet shop poisoning, she'd have been an obvious suspect when her uncle died. But if she'd already established a maniac poisoner in the village, it might have deflected our suspicions.
And now we know she went to buy some more poison. That suicide story is just eyewash.
Well, we know she tried to buy poison. We also know she failed. So how did she get hold of prussic acid, let alone strychnine?
Well, her boyfriend's a research chemist. Well, I admit Harding seems to be a pleasant young chap, but there may be more to him than meets the eye. What if he were involved right from the start? What if they planned it between them?
No, you can't have it both ways. First, she commits murder in cahoots with Emmett. Then she kills Emmett and commits another murder with Harding. You can't have her playing ring-a-ring-a-roses with every man she meets.
But just now you agreed with me. You said she started poisoning as a sort of smokescreen.
I said she could have done that. Anyone could have done that, including the actual murderer.
So you don't believe Marjorie Wills is guilty?
Absolutely right. I don't. She had no more to do with these crimes than you have.
I don't understand.
Well, what you must remember is the psychology of our murderer. Of all the forms of murder, poisoning is the most difficult to get away with.
Now, hold on a minute. You mean the easiest, don't you?
No, I mean precisely what I say.
But look here. There are people dying every day, reported as natural deaths, but who knows how many of them have been poisoned?
We don't know. What you say may be true. The graveyards may be full of corpses clamoring for vengeance. But hang it all, let's see some evidence before we assume your theory is valid.
Well, what's your opinion, then?
In my opinion, the poisoner runs a triple risk. One, he must make sure his victim doesn't live long enough to denounce him. Two, he must prove that he had neither the opportunity to administer poison nor a reason for doing so. And finally, hardest of all, he must obtain the poison without being detected. Now I'm going to show you something.
What's that?
The letter sent to me last week by Marcus Chesney. Perhaps you would read the last paragraph, Hadley.
Well, thanks. All witnesses, metaphorically, wear black spectacles.
Mm-hmm.
They do not see what goes on the stage, still less what goes on in the audience. I expect to perform a little charade before a group of friends quite soon. If all goes well, may I invite you to come and see it at a later date? I warn you, I shall try to hoodwink you in every possible way. But I'll give you a tip. Keep a close eye on my niece, Marjorie.
Marjorie? But you just said...
Yeah, I know. That's why I didn't show you the letter till now. I didn't want to mislead you. But there's a clue in there which... here he is. The very man I've been waiting for. Mr. Watkins.
Watkins? You don't mean he's a...
Oh, no, certainly not. I invited him to come and give us another film show.
Miss Wills, gentlemen, it seemed right and proper that those of you most deeply concerned should have the opportunity to see this film. Now, Mr. Watkins has kindly set up the projector, so...
I told you, I'm not sure I want to see it.
Nevertheless, I think you should. It may help us a great deal. It may even help you. We want to establish who the bogeyman really was. Now, watch closely, and you may see who killed Mr. Chesney.
You mean something might give him away?
Perhaps. Of course, if you have any objection.
No, not at all. In fact, I'd like to see it.
How about you, Mr. Harding? Any objection?
Well, I was behind the camera, so I know what's in it. But it's going to be a bit of an ordeal for Marjorie. Does she really have to...
It's all right, George. I'll be all right.
Thank you. Very well, Mr. Watkins. Let's begin.
Very good, Dr. Fell.
Lights out, please.
Here we go. Mr. Chesney sits at the table and picks up the pencil. And now...
Good Lord. And I thought it was a blowpipe dart.
Now, never mind. Now, concentrate on the intruder, who is about to... Yes, here he comes.
Now, Take a good look. Who is it?
Walter. It's got to be the way he moves, the way he stands. That's Walter. It just is.
She's right. But it can't be Walter. By that time, he was lying outside, unconscious.
Yeah, but quiet, now, Marjorie, I want you to watch Marcus's lips. He's about to say something. Tell us what he says.
He says, "I do not love thee, Dr. Fell. The reason why I cannot..."
What the devil? I tell you, it's a trick.
Yes, Marcus's last trick. A little joke at my expense. Stop the film, please. Lights on.
I don't understand. He never said
that. Of course he didn't. Therefore, this isn't the film of what you saw last night. And therefore, the murderer is the person who gave us this film.
Excuse me, back in a minute.
No, you don't!
What did you do to him?
Well, nothing. As soon as I grabbed him, he fainted. Sheer terror. He knew it was all up. Come in, Sergeant. Take him away.
Good morning, Hadley. So you decided to have a lie-in today.
I lay awake for a long time last night. There are a few points I'm not quite clear about.
Oh, my dear chap, you astonish me.
Yesterday morning, at this very table, you said it must have been a doctor who dumped that trick bag on Mrs. Terry's counter.
Now, I beg your pardon. You said that. There are other people who go around carrying luggage. Tourists, for instance. Strangers to Silbury Cross. Like George Harding. Anyway, he was the only possible suspect.
Would you mind explaining that?
Well, Marcus even gave us a clue. He said, they don't know what goes on the stage, still less what goes on in the audience. Meaning that there could be trickery among the audience, too.
In other words, one of the three spectators could be in...
Exactly. One of them might change places with Emmett and appear in the film. There was a short period of darkness before and after the show when the curtains were closed, long enough for Harding to slip out, put on a costume, while Emmett took over the camera.
Impossible. During the show, the professor heard George say, "Shh, here comes the bogeyman."
Yeah, he heard Emmett say it in a whisper. And since he was holding the cine camera, the professor assumed it was George.
But it was Emmett we saw in the film.
That version was shot much earlier, when the rest of the household were out of the way. Which is why the photo flood burned out. It was used twice.
So where's the film Emmett took during the show?
But let me explain. The scene was shot twice. First, for what we might call the dress rehearsal, with Emmett as the bogeyman. Then, during the actual performance, when Emmett and Harding changed places, Emmett held the camera.
But we've never seen that version on film.
No. Harding made sure the lens cap was left on, so the rest of the film is blank. As soon as the show was over, while Harding was tearing off his disguise, Emmett slipped out as arranged, whereupon Harding coshed him and resumed his post indoors with the camera before the lights were switched on.
Do you mean to say Harding planned all that months ago, before the Mediterranean cruise?
Well, no, not at all, no. Although as soon as he realized Marjorie was an heiress, he decided to kill Marcus and marry her for her inheritance. Unknown to Marjorie, he paid his first visit to Silbury Cross to establish the mysterious poisoner and lay the smokescreen. How he planned to finish Marcus off, we'll never know, because last week, like a gift from the gods, he got his big chance when Marcus asked him secretly to help him with the show.
Marcus set up his own murder without knowing it?
I'm afraid so. I don't think Harding meant to implicate Marjorie. He wanted her money. He didn't want her tried for murder. But by then, he realized that her passion had begun to cool.
Do you think she suspected him?
I think she saw a glimpse of his true character. Perhaps that's why she contemplated suicide. He sensed the change in her and tried to stampede her into marriage, without success.
Well, she's free of him at last. What do you think she'll do?
My guess is that she and Dr. Joe will put Belgard on the market. A lovely house, but it holds too many unhappy memories. I hope she'll make a fresh start. Build herself a new life.
I think she deserves it.
Ah, breakfast at last. This morning I ordered the entire menu with 2 eggs and extra fried bread. I think I deserve it.
In The Black Spectacles by John Dixon Carr, Dr. Gideon Fell was played by Donald Sinden. Chief Superintendent Hadley, John Hartley. Major Crowe, Reginald Marsh. Marjorie Wills, Yasmin Brett. George Harding, Andrew Wincott. Dr. Joseph Chesney, James Taylor. Professor Ingram, Colin Pinney. Mr. Watkins, Christopher Wright. Sergeant Harris, Nick Ash. The Black Spectacles was dramatized for radio by Peter Ling and directed by Enid Williams.